KBOO is currently running a Kickstarter campaign to build a city of media makers. From February 8th to March 9th, you can become a media maker and help spread the word. Just go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter between now and March 9th to join.
...than they do, and still have this fear of them. It's a fear that never goes away. So, to the destruction of fear, and to the enlightenment of the species, I salute you too for spreading the word. Thank you very much.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10:59. At 11, Between the Covers looks back at archival interview with the late Portland author Ursula K. Le Guin. At 11:30, Words and Pictures talks to the animator Gail Noonan, whose short film celebrates human relations in the natural world. Just a reminder, KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter to help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter.
Help us help you keep Portland weird. Join Contessa de la Luna of the World Famous Confessional for the 6th annual Contessa de la Luna Valentine's Spectacular and Fashion Show. We're giving away a $100 cash prize plus live performances by Contessa de la Luna. Get your weird on and bring a date. Advance tickets available at Brown Paper Tickets. All proceeds benefit your community radio station, KBOO. That's Thursday, February 15th, 7 to 9:45 p.m. Feel the love of your other Contessa de la Lunatics. Contessa de la Luna's Valentine's Spectacular, Thursday, February 15th at the Clinton Street Theater, 7 p.m.
This is Kyle Carrezzi, reporter and producer for the KBOO Evening News. For decades, KBOO News and Public Affairs has welcomed radical and spirited activists in the Northwest and beyond. As Oregon evolves, KBOO is central to connecting the world to what Portland and the Northwest is creating. We put the mic in everyone's hands, and when you join the donor circle, you're powering the microphone to amplify the stories of people in your own backyard. Join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Ursula K. Le Guin died on January 22, 2018, at the age of 88. Acclaimed for her novels, short stories, essays, and poetry, she is best known for her fantasy and science fiction, in particular her novels The Left Hand of Darkness and The Dispossessed, and her series of novels in the fantasy realm of Earthsea. In her works, she explored gender, political struggles, economics, as well as anthropology and sociology. On September 29, 2000, my former co-host Richard A. Lupoff and I spoke with Ursula K. Le Guin about her career as a writer and about her latest novel, a political and social science fiction allegory, The Telling. This program is taken from that interview, with segments from a short 1983 interview conducted by Richard A. Lupoff.
Ursula K. Le Guin, you came from a very special family, and I'd like to start by asking you about your mother and father and how they influenced your writing.
I don't remember when I started writing, so this was just something that was sort of apparently innate. And the parents encouraged it mildly. You know, they didn't say, "Ooh, look, Ursula's written a poem, isn't it wonderful?" There wasn't anything like that. They just sort of took it for granted that reading and writing were one of the things you did.
What about the fact that they were such well-known figures in the Berkeley anthropological scene?
Well, my dad was very well-known as an anthropologist, but that doesn't mean a whole lot to a 10-year-old. He went off to meetings and worked very hard, and I watched him reading and writing, and he had lots of interesting friends who came around to the house, including a couple of dear Indian friends, which was a privilege not too many white people have. But my mother was just a housewife at that point. She didn't start writing until she was in her 50s. And then her second book was a bestseller, which is such a nice fairy tale.
You began writing, and did you have trouble selling it first?
Yes. I had a lot of trouble selling. I could sell, in quotes. I could place poetry. If you just hang in there and keep sending your poems out to poetry magazines, you can get published because poetry magazines always need poetry. But the commercial aspect of things where you actually sell a story, I guess I was sending out stories and novels for 7 or 8 years before I placed anything in fiction.
Had you been reading science fiction?
Some. I read a little as a kid when I was 12 or 13. And then I kind of missed the whole Heinlein glory days. I had a friend who put me onto Cordwainer Smith along in the late 50s, I suppose, and Ted Sturgeon. And I sort of said, hey, this is different from what it used to be. This is a lot more fun. And Cordwainer Smith particularly sort of, wow, look what this guy can do.
Where were you reading these authors? Were these this is sort of the last days of the pulps? Or
yeah, these were magazines. My friend Mac was subscribing to the magazines, and then he'd pass them on to me.
Remember which ones?
Well, what would it be? It would be Amazing and Fantastic, but I don't know whether Cordwainer Smith appeared in those. Probably Galaxy and FNSF was what we were passing around in those days.
Were these early stories that you wrote, were they science fiction or fantasy, or were they mainstream?
Yes.
You wrote them all.
Yeah. I wrote quite a lot of mainstream or realistic fiction then, but often there was something slightly quirky about it. At 12, I think I was totally unaware of that magazines really had editors. I just sent it to Astounding. It came back, but that didn't decrease my childish arrogance at all. I had a real rejection slip from a real magazine. I finally broke into publishing fiction with two stories, and one went to a literary magazine, and it has a German title, An die Musik. And it's a perfectly realistic story, but it's set in an imaginary Central European country. So there was often a little oddness about my stories, which I think frightened the market. And the same week, I had a story accepted to Amazing Stories.
Was that Cecile Goldsmith, the editor at that time?
Yeah.
Did you know her personally?
No, we never met. Yeah. But she was a good editor, and she did edit. Sometimes it was a bit disastrous. In the first story that she accepted for Amazing, it's called April in Paris. It's fantasy. And she added a lot of words to the last sentence. I had something about the river. It takes place in Paris. You know, the Seine is flowing by, and when I read the story in print, it said the Seine was flowing by in all its rippling grandeur. And I went through the roof. And this was my first publication, but all the same, I did write her, and I said, where did that rippling grandeur come from? And she said, there was a widow, and I had to fill out the line. And I said, well, next time, don't do it with the last sentence of my story. And she said, okay. She really was very nice.
I'd like to ask you a question about the relationship between genre fiction and general literary fiction or so-called mainstream fiction. Joyce Carol Oates, for instance, draws a rather strong distinction between the two. Margaret Atwood says there's no difference. Some things are just written better than others. How does Ursula Le Guin feel?
I'm definitely on Maggie's side of things. I think realism, which some people want to call literature or mainstream realism, is one of the genres. And it's a fairly recent one. It's older than science fiction, but it's younger than fantasy. There wasn't any realistic fiction until the 18th century. And why we have privileged it as being the only literary narrative, I don't understand. And I do think that that distinction is breaking down pretty fast now.
When you began writing, you just wrote what came your way? Did you actually look toward writing, say, science fiction? How did that begin for you?
Just submitting to a science fiction fantasy magazine, which is what Amazing was, and they took it, and they paid me real $30. It sounds silly now, but in today's terms, that's $300 or so. Living as we were then, it was a substantial amount of money. And I thought, well, maybe these guys, the sort of odd things I do with fiction, maybe these science fiction fantasy people will accept it, and indeed they did. And then I did get serious about reading more, particularly science fiction, so that, you know, you can't write in any field without knowing what's going on in that field. And science fiction is particularly that way. You sort of have to know what's been done and what people are doing so that you don't reinvent the wheel all the time.
But did you get that feeling, the distinction that Dick was talking about between, say, mainstream and science fiction?
Oh, yeah. Back then, it was science fiction was absolutely a ghetto. But after 7 or 8 years of sending out stories and novels and not getting any publications, you get fairly desperate. I didn't care who published me. And the fact that I might be stigmatizing myself and getting a big red SF branded on my forehead, you know, among the intelligentsia, I could have cared less. I just wanted to get my stories out there and get somebody reading them. You know, that's what a writer wants. You know, since then I realized that perhaps career-wise this was a risky move. But, you know, I really don't care. I would have gone ahead writing what I write anyway.
You did get started in the 60s. Your first novels were to Don Walheim at Ace Books.
Remember, there was no SFWA then. There was not very good information for a young writer in science fiction. At least I didn't know how to get it if there was good information going. I've always tended to work rather alone and not ask questions. So I just sent it to the publisher who published most of the books I was reading, and that was Walheim at Ace. Ace was essentially science fiction to me. And he was, you know, he was doing fairly experimental things, and right along in there he started the Ace Specials, got Terry Carr to buy those for him. So I was coming in right at the perfect moment to sell to Don Walheim, I think. And of course, the first two books were those Ace Doubles. They're now collector's items. I was on with Tom Dish on one and Avram Davidson on the other. What better company could a young writer ask for?
These early days in your career, I wonder what your dealings were like with these editors. Was it just, you know, send off the manuscript and get back a check, or was there more going on than that?
I had no agent. Typical naive young writer. I signed the total giveaway contract. Well, everybody has to start somewhere. I hold no rancor against the Ace contracts of those days. At least they got us all started.
The breakthrough novels, at least to my way of thinking, there were three in number, and they were Left Hand of Darkness, Lathe of Heaven, and The Dispossessed. Outside of the science fiction field, what kind of response was there to these books? I mean, I found the Dispossessed to be one of the greatest dystopia novels I ever read.
Okay, well, now we're sticking strictly to my science fiction, because along in there, after all, came A Wizard of Earthsea.
That's true,
also.
Yeah.
The reception of Left Hand of Darkness, of course, just took me totally by surprise. I thought people would hate this book where I disgendered people, as it were, and instead the readers really liked it and continued to like it. And it caused a satisfying amount of controversy and argument and so on. Then Lathe of Heaven isn't a controversial book. It just sort of got me more solidly ensconced as a science fiction writer, I guess. And then Dispossessed, which is a utopia dystopia thing. It got read very seriously in Europe. It got translated quickly and taken pretty seriously in France and Germany and places like that. And academics do tend eventually to notice that. So I would say academically that book's probably been discussed more than the others by serious academic critics. But reviewers, newspaper reviewers, and that non-academic critics, none of these books was ever reviewed, I think. I believe the first review I ever had in the New York Times that wasn't in a little corral or ghetto with the other SF, you know, or sci-fi, was Always Coming Home. I think that one had a front page review by Chip Delaney.
Who was also a science fiction person.
Who's a science fiction. Of course they, but that's right. They, in a sense, particularly then, you had to get a science fiction person to review science fiction because the ordinary critics and the academics didn't know how to read it. They hadn't trained themselves. They were it's like the Harry Potter thing. All these people saying, ooh, wow, how original the story. You know, nobody's ever done anything like this before. These are people who apparently haven't ever read any fantasy. They have managed not to notice the existence of Tolkien.
Can you talk about how you came to write The Lathe of Heaven and The Dispossessed?
Well, Lathe of Heaven, I'd been reading, you know, just absolutely for pleasure, for the pleasure of learning about all that sleep and dream research that field was just opening up. back then. What was that, mid-60s? I think that's when they were all dement, and those people were all just opening up this lovely whole new field of psychological, physiological research, and I was reading everything that came out, and most of them could write well. So it was a pleasure to read their papers, you know, and so on. So I had just sort of floundered around in that for 2-3 years. And the book just sort of started itself. And all the research, in quotes, had been done. I sort of knew the field pretty well. So I could just sit down and write the book. And it was a book that wrote itself. I plotted it very little. How could I? I mean, George had to have another dream all the time. And I did not investigate too far where I was going. And I laughed like crazy writing it. It was a lot of fun to write. It just poured out. Dispossessed is just the opposite. Dispossessed grew from an aborted short story that was lousy, rotten short story. But I knew there was a good idea in it. I knew I had to know more about, I needed some kind of political structure. I started reading Utopias, read Paul Goodman, read Communitas by Paul and Percival Goodman, got sent into anarchism, spent a couple of years reading there, and then was ready to start very carefully planning and plotting out the book, you see. So that was a constructed book. Lathe was a poured-out book. I don't think they read all that differently, though, is the funny thing. Lathe might be a little wordy. If I rewrote that book now, I would cut a little more sternly than I did. My trilogy was totally accidental. I had no intention of writing a trilogy. It was not a fad at the time. There were a couple of fantasy trilogies around, but it wasn't it wasn't sort of de rigueur the way it is now.
Is that a trilogy or it's a trilogy?
Well, this...
Oh, this is really embarrassing, David.
I'm sorry.
It was a four-book trilogy until I wrote two more books, which are going to come out. So now what do we call a sexology? let's just drop that word trilogy here, okay?
You're listening to an interview with the late Ursula K. Le Guin, conducted on September 29, 2000, while on tour for her novel, The Telling. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.
There was what I thought a very remarkable motion picture based on The Lathe of Heaven. How did that come about?
It came about because of David Loxton at WNET, Channel 13 in New York. He had a dream of narrative television, and he unfortunately died very soon after he made Lathe of Heaven. And took his dreams with him. It was the most successful dramatic film that public television ever showed, apparently.
Tell us about the production of that. Who did the screenplay? Who was in the cast? Who directed it? Was it Loxton directed it?
Yeah, Loxton and Fred Barzyk from the Boston station. They asked me to write the screenplay, and I'd never written a screenplay or even thought about it. And I said, I can't, you know, I can't just plunge in and learn how to write a screenplay cold with my own book. They hired Roger Swabel, who did a very good job in some ways and a terrible job in other ways. And so we did an awful lot of rewrites. And I was in on the rewrites. I was in on casting. I was in on as much of that movie as I was able to be in on. I was included in a way writers are very, very seldom. In fact, I don't know any other writer that was in on their movie the way I was included. With a real voice, really being listened to, and having a lot of fun. It was a great crew, a great photographer, good music, and we had to do the whole thing on $750,000. If you look at the special effects in The Lathe of Heaven, they ain't exactly state of the art. I think it is kind of a lesson that you know, special effects are a lot of fun, but it's kind of you've seen them once, you've seen them. Whereas your story and your acting, because we had awfully good actors, is kind of where it's at.
Outside of Lathe of Heaven, your science fiction novels all seem to fall into a specific universe, the universe of the Hainish and something called the Ansible, which is a radio communication device that cuts across light years.
It's instantaneous communication.
Yeah. Dick told me that Ansible, the idea, preceded Ursula K. Le Guin.
Well, the idea of instantaneous communication undoubtedly preceded me by a long, long time. But it was just a convenience. Since I have an Einsteinian universe where you can't travel faster than light, Or you can't do it very successfully. Actually, I have a couple of stories in which confusions happen when people try it. But that means that everybody's hundreds of light years away from each other. How can you have a novelistic universe where people interact if they can't even talk? So my friend Shevik, the physicist from Anaris, invented the Ansible for me. I think I used it in my first or second novel.
What prompted you to keep using that same universe? Was it that?
Laziness? Laziness, yeah. Why reinvent the universe if you've gone to all that trouble to do it once? The trouble is I keep forgetting bits of it.
How far in the future do these books take place?
Quite a long time ahead. I'm awfully careless about that. I'm always losing millennia, too. You know, I have figured it out. Because it takes so long to get to places when you only have nearly light speed, we get pretty far into the future. We're getting up in, I suppose, a couple of millennia.
I get the sense that your latest book, The Telling, takes place at around the same time as The Dispossessed, or perhaps a little bit later.
It's later, because the Ansible is well established. You see, this is the kind of thing where I'm very sloppy about this universe. But on the other hand, it seems not very far in the future in Earth terms. The Earth part of it seems within the next couple of hundred years at most, because we have the same country names and languages and so on.
The Earth part of The Telling, we see a future which is enough like our present world to be recognizable, but it's sufficiently different to be pretty frightening. As for the changes in the world, which are largely the result of human tinkering.
You don't really get very much picture of Earth in The Telling. You see that the sea has risen. That seems a fairly safe bet at this point, because, you know, old Vancouver is underwater. That's about all you get, isn't it?
There's a lot more, mostly in the mind of our heroine.
Well, there's the political stuff, the political religious stuff. We apparently, the world has been pretty much taken over by a fundamentalist theocracy, about which we learn really very little.
Well, let's talk about this fundamentalist theocracy. It reminded me a little bit of Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale. Octavia Butler has addressed some of the same issues. And I'm starting, plus also simply picking up my morning newspaper. This seems to be a remarkably powerful and, to me, both puzzling and distressing trend in the way our society is working.
Fundamentalism. Yes, me too. I think that's why it's coming out in fiction, is that this is something that is worrying a lot of people. And religions that never were fundamentalists, such as Hinduism, suddenly they're getting aggressive, whereas I think of Hinduism historically as incredibly accepting, a sort of an embracing religion. And now it's no. So we're right, you're wrong, you know, that sort of thing. This is very frightening to me.
We are all living in an age, or have lived in an age, where it looked for a while as if rationality and tolerance were becoming acceptable and the way people thought and related to one another. And that all... I remember them. Yes, I think they happened in May. We've gone into reverse gear on that, and we're moving faster and faster away from it. I would just like to know if you have any idea, any theory even, as to what's going on and why is it going on?
I guess I don't really know that it's any worse than it's always been, except there are more of us. Everything we do is more disastrous because we are already severely overpopulated. Every problem becomes insoluble when there's too many of you and when, you know, there's 20 more of you born every second. But, you know, I was a kid in the 30s, and I suppose it seems ancient and quaint to a lot of people now, but the 30s were not a nice decade. There was really bad stuff happening. We were mostly aware at that point, it wasn't as much one world then, it was Europe. We were fixated on Europe, but after all, there was Japan. There was really bad stuff happening all over the world, and it was very frightening, and a lot of people really thought that the age of reason was gone and the chaos was what we faced forever. It really felt that way in 1939 to a lot of people. So I guess in a sense, we have to realize that we've sort of been there and done that, and we'll be there again.
In the telling, you portray more than one future. I don't mean in the sense of parallel worlds, but different places. And the one future in which religion is dominant, and we get the feeling that religion hates and fears science. This is a concept and a kind of imagery that we have encountered before. But what about the concept and the imagery where science hates and fears religion? That's much more unusual.
They do seem to often get on opposite sides of a fence and start shouting at each other. It does seem also rather unnecessary, I think, to many scientists and many religious people. The whole confrontational territorial thing seems an awful waste of time, that there is no essential conflict between the scientific method and the spiritual outlook. But the fundamentalisms get dug in, and not so much scientists, but the myth of progress is really what's the villain in the other world in the telling on Akka, is that they have bought into the myth of progress. They've replaced their religion with another religion, which is the religion of constant growth, capitalistic growth, and technological progress, that this is going to supply the meaning of life. Progress, capitalism, high tech, losing all the low tech skills, making things really well and so on, and going in for kind of shoddy high tech. And of course, we're doing that right now, in a sense. Isn't this a bit of a fairly obvious satire on the way the West moves in to what we call less advanced countries and takes over, and where they were eating something good, you get McDonald's, you know, and so on. And then, of course, as for a religion giving in, that's a sticky thing. See, the idea for the book came from Mao's suppression of the practice of Taoism in China. And he did seem to suppress it with appalling rapidity and ease. And I don't know that they've given in, but they've certainly had to go underground. You know, if you got enough soldiers on your side, you can suppress anything.
But religion does seem to come back. And in fact, if we look at contemporary China.
Well, and yeah, we've got some sort of new cult, which the government is wildly anxious about and is stamping out right and left. But then comes another new cult. On the other hand, these are cults. They tend to have a leader and so on. They're different from what was a great 3,000-year-old popular religion, which was, you know, kind of deeply ingrained in the culture. Something there may have been permanently lost. We don't really know. How much do we really know about what's going on in China?
Why is this idea of progress, say, or technology so powerful that it will completely wipe out everything in its path? And I'm thinking not merely just, you know, you could walk in and with an army and destroy a culture.
Yeah. The white West has essentially just done it by arriving with always a slight edge technologically. I mean, even in Peru, the Spanish weren't really, in many ways, they were not as advanced as the Incas, but they had horses, they had armor, and they had guns that made a big loud noise. And there goes the Inca Empire. I mean, when you put it in those stark terms, or like the conquest of Mexico, you sort of say, what? You know, 65 Spaniards topple an empire? But they did. I think it's a big question that nobody's ever answered.
Ursula K. Le Guin, in your books, I'd like to delve into what exactly Ursula Le Guin is doing by creating parallel worlds that mirror our own.
Basically, to put it bluntly, I think in fiction. I can't think abstractly. If I have a big problem that worries me, like the one we were just talking about, you know, it starts taking the form of a story. And I imagine, to simplify the issues, of course, that's where science fiction is so beautiful, is you can make up a world where you don't have to cope with all the other things that are going on. You can kind of concentrate and simplify your world fictionally, which all fiction does. All fiction leaves out about 99% of the world. But you can do that selectively in science fiction in a particular way, which is a lot of fun both for writer and reader.
What about the way character interacts, the characters that you create interact?
They're the heart of the book. I mean, I couldn't start the telling, although I knew what I wanted to write about. I couldn't tell the story until I got the viewpoint character. And until she sort of came and began talking to me, as it were, I didn't have the book. After a lot of full starts and a lot of attempts at a different viewpoint character, it's like Seti sort of moseys in and says, hello, I'm here. Now I'm going to tell you this story. Then I begin taking dictation, in a sense. I'm not totally out of control.
You've been listening to an interview with the late novelist, poet, and essayist Ursula K. Le Guin, conducted on September 29, 2000, while she was on tour for her novel, The Telling. My co-host was Richard A. Lupoff, and I'm Richard Walensky. The complete interview can be found as a Radio Walensky podcast in the Area 941 section of kpfa.org. You can contact me by writing to bookwaves@hotmail.com. Bookwaves is produced by Richard Walensky in the studios of KPFA Pacifica Radio in Berkeley, California.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the screening of Big Pharma on Sunday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Big Pharma examines the problem of extreme drug prices in the U.S. and how drug prices impact business, the public, and the overall U.S. economy. The film will be followed by a discussion with Oregon State Representative Rob Noose. Again, that's the screening of Big Pharma on Sunday, February 18th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
When radio got taken over by advertising, people in Portland decided to do it themselves, and in 1968, they created a space that was free from advertisers and independent from corporate or mainstream media interests, KBOO Community Radio. This is the very essence of DIY culture. KBOO was here in the 70s as people were taking back music spaces, in the 80s when artists were taking back music distribution, and in the 90s supporting zine and small press revolutions and all of the movements of self-expression. Help us build a city of artistic media makers. Long live DIY radio and join us on Kickstarter today.
Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. Donate to the campaign and share it with your friends. And thank you for your support of KBOO.
Good morning. It is about 11:30. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Words and Pictures talks to animator Gail Noonan, whose short films celebrate human relations and the natural world. And just a reminder, KBOO's Kickstarter is live. Go to kboo.fm/Kickstarter. And help KBOO build a city of media makers. That's kboo.fm/Kickstarter. KBOO has been around for about 50 years, and it's people like you that keeps the station going. And a way for you to show support is by supporting our Kickstarter. Go online, and let's make another 50 years of KBOO.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm joined today by an acclaimed visual artist and very independent filmmaker. She's known for her short films that combine music and ambient sound with multiple animation styles and techniques. Gail Noonan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, right now you're being celebrated by the Northwest Film Center in Portland. They've brought you down from British Columbia as one of the trailblazing women of independent animation. This is good company to be in.
Oh, I am so pleased to be with those other wonderful trailblazers. I feel very honored to be in their company.
Yeah, they're an amazing group of Northwest artists that include Ruth Hayes from Olympia, Washington, Joan Gratz, two-time Academy Award winner, plus Rose Bond, Joanna Priestley, and Marilyn Zornado.
No, I'm more than pleased and tickled pink and honored. And, you know, I was telling my friends back home, I guess I have to fall off my perch now. I'm having a retrospective. That's it. I'm done. I'm finished. Over.
Well, you started out as a visual artist, mostly in printmaking. I understand that you grew up way out east on the eastern seaboard in rural Nova Scotia in Canada.
Yes.
And so what first drew you into the art scene?
Well, I was an awkward geek. So I was drawing was the refuge, and that was kind of how I could connect to people, was through drawing. So I always drew and went to art school. I wanted to go to a place as different from a village on the coast of Nova Scotia as I could possibly think of. So I thought, okay, a city in the prairies. So I applied to the University of Manitoba and ended up in Winnipeg, the smack dab in the middle of the country, where I went to art school and lived there. Ended up majoring, focusing on printmaking, on etching, and lived there for the next 12 years.
Obviously, in Winnipeg, it gets crazy cold, wind chill off the prairies. So you're inside a lot doing your art. And I'm assuming you have some opportunities to gather with other artists, although many of your pursuits would be solitary.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, there was always a really good potluck, especially in winter. Well, winter and summer. And I found that mainly going through art school, it would be your classmates and their friends that would sort of form your cohort. And again, that would be quite cross-disciplinary, you know, where there would be a group of us who would be writers, visual artists, architects, musicians, filmmakers, the gamut. Yeah.
And you were a printmaker at the time.
Yes. I was part of North Nassau Printmakers, which was, again, a small cooperative group of printmakers that was then, the building we were in was turned into actually a big art center, which is now where the Winnipeg Film Group is, and a number of other arts organizations. I think it's Martha Street Studios now. And it was a wonderful place to go work, where there was common space. We all shared presses and the acids and the major infrastructure was there for printmaking. It was in the old district of Winnipeg, where there were theaters and alternate galleries, plug-in gallery. So there was a nice little enclave there of sort of artist-run centers. That was a great area to be in.
What techniques, old and new, fascinated you about printmaking?
Well, the thing I loved about etching, I think I've always loved the... My drawing style was always about kind of creating little stories. And what I loved about etchings is that because you're working on a metal plate and you're scratching through an emulsion that you'll then etch, you pull a print and the plate makes a dent in the paper. So there's very much an enclosed world where the story in that etching lives. And also, the image is backwards. So you have to sort of think backwards and how the image is going to look forward. So you end up with this kind of objectivity about the images you're creating. So I love that little enclosed world. And I found that was the same thing once I sort of did this lateral transfer from printmaking into animation. Because I was working with little stories, it seemed the next step was really make those stories come to life, make them move, and also incorporate sound and music. So what I found with film is that there was that same enclosed world in the screen. That became the world the characters could live in. So it made for a much... sort of the next step in the evolution of that sort of storytelling style.
Well, when you did try your hand at filmmaking for the first time with your short film, Play Ball, it was a big success, won awards, and so it sounds like that was when your filmmaking career got launched.
It was wonderful encouragement. I think the first experience, I went to a festival, the Yorkton Short Film and Video Festival, and that's where Play Ball won it's the Animation Award, which absolutely shocked me to no end because I was up against very stiff competition. And also I was there. I was actually able to sort of witness it and meet other filmmakers that I'm actually still friends with to this day. And I think when you get that kind of encouragement right off the bat, it does help you keep making films. And you get to see how people respond to your work in an audience. And that to me is also, that's the culminating side of making a film. It's a time-based medium, which is the big difference between that and printmaking is, you know, prints, I'm fine with people discovering my prints on their own time and they'll find them. But with film, the film has to be projected. So there's an opportunistic element to that. And also it's time-based. So people can only experience it for that set period of time.
Well, this is why it's so important to still have cinemas, still have places where people can gather together and watch a film on the big screen is to connect with the artist in a real way and to have the artist connect with the audience as well and get that feedback. It's almost like the filmmaker is an actor on stage, you know, in the live theater. No performance is ever the same way twice because it's an interaction between the performers and the audience.
Yes, and it's interesting, especially with short film, context is everything. So yes, people bring their experiences to the film when they watch the film, and that can be very much colored by what they've seen before, just before, or what's happening in their life, you know. And so people will resonate with different aspects of a film. And it's always interesting to see when you show a film what people take away from it.
Now, you are known for your short films, and you've had great success with a whole series of short films and often very short films. The market seems to be somewhat not as broad for short films as it used to be, and maybe that's just in the U.S. I think there is still an interest in Europe, in Japan, maybe even in Canada, for short films on television. You know, not everybody needs to go in and make a feature.
Well, it's an interesting thing because I used to have a T-shirt that said short films are the laboratory of film. And what I find is that the short film programs in any festival I go to, that's where I'm most engaged and that's where I see most experimentation. And you see people veering away from the tried and true because there isn't a huge amount of money involved. I mean, once you're into features, then suddenly with all those expenses, even with the cheaper way of making films now, there's a lot more at stake. So people tend to fall back into, well, A, there's a lot more people making decisions about what the story is going to be and how that story is going to be portrayed. I'm all for collaboration, but it has to be creative collaboration. It really can't be about whoever is bringing the money to the table deciding what's going to happen. I think that's where things can really go south because if you're putting a lot of money into something, then you'll want to get your money back. Whereas with short film, really, it's about the storytelling and it's about the expression. So I find it vital, really vital and alive. You know, hats off to feature filmmakers. I can't wait to see Joanna Priestley's film because I just think, wow, not only did she do a feature, an animated feature, it's an abstract animated feature. That's fantastic. So I'm impressed to that. And it's very, very inspiring, though. I do think I will always be concise and on the short side.
Sound is very important to you. Music, sound effects, ambient audio. And I think this is true of a lot of really successful animation filmmakers is they realize that sound is half the project. People don't pay as much attention to it, but when it's not there or when it's not done well, it can really sink a film.
Oh, yes. I would almost say that sound is like 60, it's 60-40. Because, and also sound it can really help you establish an atmosphere and a sense of space that you don't have to create because it's there in the sound. And I think sound touches our psyche in a really immediate kind of way. So you can do all kinds of subliminal atmospheric things with layers and layers of sound. And people don't necessarily have to consciously be aware of what that sound is, but it will definitely affect them emotionally in a very subconscious way.
Well, your short film, Your Name in Cellulite, is a satire, and so many of your short films are very satirical, and the themes here are advertising culture and marketing and the beauty industry and women's bodies and body image. And these themes also come up in other films. You know, More Sensitive is another great satirical short film that I like. Obviously, you're inspired by audiences and how they react to that. What are some of your other inspirations? I mean, are you a fan of satirical literature, for example?
Well, I would say what I like to do is sort of draw analogies between the macro and the micro. So with Your Name in Cellulite, it was a combination of how a woman's body is viewed as something that's to be manipulated and shaped and contoured to the purpose of the other, of the observer, of whoever's going to consume this body. That's the same attitude as we have towards the earth. We can change the direction of rivers. We can pillage and mine and plunder and clear cut the earth. And the ramifications are the same. The same way that we approach women's bodies and increasingly men's, you know, because that's a whole other market share. You know, we can't miss that. But I really focused on that because it was so apparent to me that when this woman conforms to what is viewed as the prescribed image of femininity, which is also sort of an element of survival, you know, is she's so constrained, so restrained, so immobilized that her body just rebels. And I think the same thing is happening now with the world. The world is just rebelling. You know, we've messed around enough, and now it's just, you know, rolling over and threatening us along with it. It's like we have to smarten up really fast with the environment. We can't treat it in a cavalier fashion. It's not there just for us to use. It's an entity, and we are a part of that entity, not the ruler, not the owner. The same way no one's body is owned by anybody else. And you have to consider the entire ecology. So I think that's kind of more the direction where I come from. The same with More Sensitive. It's based on a film that a friend of mine wrote. It's a jazz singer. It's a self-parody, actually, of himself. He's a brilliant jazz musician, but it's a parody of his singing. And the song is about being more sensitive than everybody else, which in reality the singer isn't. So
sensitive new age guy.
Yes, sensitive new age guy. And you know, when I fall in love, it hurts me more than you can ever possibly imagine. So, and again, I bring in elements of the environment. You know, when he falls in love, it's a box of chocolates and the chocolates explode, and then there's lots of little orca whales that come up, and then the ocean is actually a sea of styrofoam and tampons and detritus. That is the thing I like to play with, is how can we take our immediate personal experience and look at it in terms of the broader context.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and I'm talking today with animator and visual artist Gail Noonan. She's known for her short films that combine music and ambient sound with multiple animation styles and techniques. So many of your films, Menopause Song, Your Name in Cellulite, these are themes that women can immediately relate to, and men can be introduced to these topics in an aha sort of manner. So do you sort of see yourself as an educator, as somebody who's trying to expand the conversation out there?
No, I'm incredibly selfish with my film. I make films I want to see. So I make films and subjects that I'm interested in. I try really not to think of the audience at all. And I don't take a pedantic view at all in my filmmaking. I really like it when things resonate with people. I mean, when I made my film Your Name in Cellulite, I seriously had no idea that people would respond to it as broadly as they did. I mean, I saw older women saying, I'm throwing out those high heel shoes. I saw fathers saying, I'm going to get this for my daughter. I'm going to get this. Young men saying, I'm getting this for my wife and my girlfriend. It crossed a lot of lines. And I really made that film for something that I needed to see at the time. You know, I was looking at a lot of bizarre plastic surgery, Botox, liposuction. A lot of women were experiencing eating disorders, starving themselves to death. And it was actually realizing that women were dying from these attempts to attain this so-called image of perfection. So it was something I really needed to see. And, you know, with the menopause song, I actually wrote the song first, and I wrote it in a really bad day of cramps, and I just needed some kind of relief. You know, this is going to end someday. I was just really expressing something for myself. So when other people vibe into it, that's the best. That's great, because I really don't have any intention, really, of consciously educating or consciously trying to sway anybody's opinion or anything. But if you can come along for the ride, if it actually engages you to watch and to listen, and it makes you think, oh, wow, that's bonus. That's wonderful. I'm happy.
This is the place that creative people find themselves in all the time, writers and artists. They want to find a book, a film, a story to look at, to take in, and it's not there. So, dagnabbit, I guess I'm going to have to make it myself.
Well, it's an interesting state to get in, to think that you can take some concept from a thought and actually bring it to life and bring it to something that other people can see and hear and experience. I think once you make that leap, that's one of the best experiences. I used to teach for a while too, and I would tell my students, you don't have to stay a filmmaker or an animator. The best thing you can know that you can get out of this is that you can take something from idea to completion, and know that you can bring that something that you has just been in your head, you can bring it into the world, and then other people can share it. Other people will experience this too.
The techniques that you use in your animation, they're just so wide-ranging. Everything from drawn animation to collage to clay to objects. Mm. But the one thing that seems to be missing, unless I've missed something, is I haven't seen any computer-generated imagery from you, no computer animation. So your work seems just very tangible. There's something when I look at your short films, I just sort of imagine being able to reach out and touch everything that's on the screen.
I am a very sort of tactile person, and I've found that computer-generated imagery isn't really something that speaks to me. I've seen other people do it very, very well, but not for me. And the way that you need to engage in just the creative methods for computer-generated imagery and computer animation, you know, working more with graphs and vectors rather than actually moving something a frame at a time. I mean, that's just sort of my tradition and my way of doing things. But I actually did make a computer-generated film. Well, I made it using an Amiga back in 1996. And I discovered...
I remember the Amiga.
Oh, the Amiga was just the best. It really was the best, because I was only going to use it as a recording device, as a capture device. And I grabbed an object and I accidentally moved the mouse, and it painted with that object. And I realized, this is a tool. You can do things with a computer that you can't do other ways. And I've never really been able to recapture that trying to use After Effects or Photoshop or any of the other sort of currently available programs. I know it can happen. I know. I have a bit of an attitude issue, I think, with them. But anyway, I made that film in 96. I created a sort of set of laws for myself. I could only use 48 photographs of a group that I was singing with at the time and images from garden catalogs that I got in the mail. And we sang the song. It was a song I'd written called The Menopause Song in a studio on island. It was the latest technology, digital recording, but it was powered off a car battery, so, and one microphone. So we sang around that microphone. And as the lights grew dim, we sang around a candle because there wasn't enough power to have both the light on and this recording and mixing board powered, you know, in this off-grid sound studio. So that's how I made my first only computer-generated film. But then I veered back to my cell painting and very traditional ways and shooting on film.
I remember Linda Barry talking about how she had trouble writing a book on her laptop, and then she just got out reams of paper and crayons, and that opened it up. Just being that tactile opened up something between the mind and the body.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, so your work as a printmaker with all the textures and etching and embossing, it seems like that really informed how you would tackle making a film.
I think I've always been attracted to ritual, and there's a very strong ritual and craft, the element of craft. So there's a very strong ritual in printmaking where you prepare the surface and you bevel the edges and you polish the plate. So you do a lot of work before you ever scratch the surface of the plate. And with animation, there's the same thing where you punch the paper, you create your sets, and also you can do a lot of editing in the storyboard stage. You can do a lot of pre-planning. And then there's that element of repetition. You have to get into kind of a very zen sort of state. And even though I've departed from, I used to quite rigorously storyboard and quite religiously follow that storyboard in my planning process, now I actually try to do what's called straight ahead animation. I just try to intuitively let the images flow as they will. I'll start out with a game plan, but if it departs from that, it can go where it will. But I find that you still get in that particular sort of state of mind, or you're almost in a kind of alternate reality at that point. And I think that follows through from the printmaking as well. Even though it's no longer a literal narrative, you're kind of in the flow of this series of ideas.
Some of my favorite animation directors are traditional artists, you know, not so much the computer effects people. And they're also women. Marjan Satrapi, Nora Toomey, Joanna Quinn. And I think that also has something to say about how women directors have been neglected for so long by the big studios, who are generally more taken with the flashy, shiny things. It's getting better, but it's getting better slowly.
Yes, I agree. And a part of that is, I think there's been an economic imperative behind that. And it harkens back to what we were talking about earlier, how it takes a lot of money to make feature films, and so they must make their money back. And there isn't a lot of faith in a type of storytelling that might be a little more introspective, that might be less sensational, but more taking you along a different experiential path, because it's riskier. And also you're getting into a kind of territory that might make a lot of funders uncomfortable. You know, excitement, humor is great and horror is great. It engages people in a really obvious, visible, they laugh, they scream. But when you take people on a more thought-provoking and or more emotive experience, then you don't see right away if it's having an impact on people.
So your short films play at a lot of screenings and festivals and at this retrospective at the Northwest Film Center. But Gosh, I've been having a hard time finding out where to get hold of a collection of your films. Can you help me out on that front?
In the old video days, I used to have a collection. It was called The Laughing Feminist, which was the first four films. Playball, Two Beautiful Stars, Your Name and Cellulite, and The Menopause Song were on that compilation. And then since then, I've kind of fallen off the wagon of that sort of marketing and very practical, how do you get to see my films? I have a YouTube channel. I have a Vimeo channel. But I'm really amiss. I have two distributors, Women Make Movies. They distribute Your Name and Cellulite. And then there's Moving Images in Vancouver that distributes everything else. But I really have to get a grip on how people can actually see a collection of the films. So that's a good nudge. It's a very good prompt.
Well, tell our listeners how to find out more about your work, please.
Well, I do have a website, Cartoon and Films, CARTOONAN Films, and you'll find out about the films there. And I'm starting to develop that site a lot more so that there'll be links to be able to see the films online. Then after that, I'm building a tower and broadcasting from
a tower.
No,
okay.
I'm going to take over the lighthouse on Main Island and broadcast from there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is it a working lighthouse?
Unfortunately, well, yes and no. It has the equivalent of about a 60-watt bulb that's solar-powered that does do its circuit at night. You can see it, but the foghorn has been disengaged. But the building is standing, and they're keeping the area as a park, which is very nice because it's on a beautiful shoreline, gorgeous sunrises and sunsets. So,
okay, you've convinced me. I have to come visit.
Yes, of course, of course.
Hop a ferry.
Yes, hop a plane, hop a ferry.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today has been animator and visual artist Gail Noonan. Gail, thank you so much for dropping by today.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it's been lovely to visit Portland.
Well, many thanks to all our listeners today on the radio dial and at kboo.fm. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Words and Picture.
It's time for the KBOO News at noon for Thursday, February 15th, 2018. Following a horrific mass shooting at a school in Florida yesterday that resulted in 17 deaths, Democratic Senator Bill Nelson from Florida has demanded congressional action. Trump offered thoughts and prayers, but no policy recommendations following the attack.